Right, everybody, if we could begin. My name is John Eatwell. I'm the president of Queen's College, Cambridge, and I'm chairing this particular session on financial crises and global governance. The group who are meeting over the 2 days of today and tomorrow have already had an afternoon discussing these issues. And something that became very evident was that there's no clear agreement on the analytical framework for attacking these issues, although there has been a considerable erosion since the financial crises of 97-98 of the view that the direct policy intervention would be undesirable, which was the view prior to 97-98, and more active approaches to managing or interfering with, in some way or other, over which there's great disagreement, over some way or other, in international financial flows is desirable in the interests of international financial stability. One thing that did come out with some agreement over the afternoon was that international financial crises are not a developing country problem. They are a world problem. And that is the policy measures likely to alleviate the impact of international financial crises are as much necessary in the developed world as in the developing world. It has to be seen as an international whole. Now, we have four speakers to address this public forum this evening. And we're simply going to take them in alphabetical order. I'm going to ask them to speak for just 20 minutes. There's a clock I noticed very helpfully on the balcony over there. So everybody can look at the clock and time themselves for 20 minutes. And then following there, we'll have, if everybody keeps to time, we'll have an ample period for questions and discussion. So I'd like to start off by asking Michel Aglietta to speak to us. You want to speak up there? Just here is fine. Okay.
Thank you very much. So I think that the IMF is a key institution for global governance in financial matters. So I want to talk about the reform of the IMF as a point of view to tackle the whole process. What I will say comes from a book I've just published about a very long and in-depth study about how IMF adjusted to the transformation of the international monetary system since the beginning, since Bretton Woods in 1944. That is very interesting because we are maybe at a point where the transformation have to go on. And the IMF will keep its grasp on governance if it is able to transform itself in order to handle the new issues and the new problems that are going with globalization. What is interesting when we look at the IMF in the long run is the fact that it was built upon two principles. The first one is universality of its membership. That is a very important principle. It has to keep the universality alive. And that's very interesting when we consider some reforms that are proposed now by some people, essentially close from maybe ultra-liberal people, for instance, the Metzler report that put in jeopardy this principle of universality. And the second is the consistency of its collective action. That is, the IMF has always emphasized efficiency of concrete, practical matters in its intervention. The way to do that was to run procedures. And those procedures is a continuity in this transformation of the content of its actions within the change in the monetary and financial structure. The procedures are surveillance and conditionality. They were developed since the early 50s, and they went through all the changes that occurred afterwards. The permanence is with procedures, with monetary doctrine that feed the IMF actions, and essentially a political requirement of universality. But the collective action is the content, a practical content of what it is doing, has changed a lot. And after analyzing that, we arrive, because I say we, not because of Majesty, but because the research and the book was made with a co-author, we arrived at four models. We can synthesize and theorize the consistency of IMF practices within, I think, four models. Those four models come through times as responses of structural transformation in the international monetary systems, but they were piled up. One was not jettisoned when the other came. So the IMF has become a very complex institution running different models that are partly contradictory. The first model is the model of origin, mutual assistance between countries that have short-run problems in balance of payment. It comes from a principle of insurance, international insurance between nations. It is made to help member countries overcome short-run current account imbalances. The second model occurred after the Bretton Woods exchange rate system broke down, and the Committee of 20 came in order to reform, and it was an aborted reform, but this aborted reform gave an offspring, that is the SDR. And so if the second model was not developed but neutralized, it still has, it is a model of issuer of a fiat currency for the world. And that is a big, tremendous innovation that could be relived in different contexts, as I will come later. Issue of fiat money, a pure fiat money, a money that is not liability of any country, liability of any economic agent. A pure fiat money that is really a tremendous innovation, but which was not used and was not developed as the primary reserve asset as the C20 wanted it to be. The third model became pragmatically from the oil crisis and all the consequences, and the beginning of globalization. It is a model of financial intermediary between a set of countries, a debtor, creditor countries. So it's very different from the first one, the model of mutual assistance. In the model of mutual assistance, every country could be, as in an insurance mechanism, a debtor or a creditor, depending on the circumstances. In the third one, the interest of creditors and the interest of debtors were structurally separated, and the IMF had to develop the monitoring of structural adjustment of the debtor countries. And it had also to lengthen its financial commitment. So the financial commitments were lengthened a lot, and the financial facilities were piled up with very different constraints and restraints upon it. This financial intermediary model was finally contested the Asian crisis, and it is the model now that is at stake in the new international financial architecture. And a fourth model occurred. A fourth model emerged in emergency, and is the question of organizing it in a permanent basis, I think, is the problem of the time. That is the model of a systemic crisis manager to meet the worldwide crisis, financial crisis, coming with financial globalization. So if you look at the philosophy underlie those models. The first one, and somewhat the third, come from an insurance mutual insurance principle between countries in a world of free markets. And the second and the fourth with the embryo of a function of international lender of last resort that is part of a model of systemic crisis manager comes from monetary sovereignty principle. And this opposition between insurance between national countries and monetary sovereignty is exactly the debate that occurred between Keynes and White, that is between the founders of Bretton Woods. We come back to the deepest of all problems, that is what is the political philosophy behind a global governance. Will it be insurance, or will it be the progressive rise of international monetary sovereignty coming with the globalization in finance to support it? I think the debate in doctrine should be related to this philosophical debate. Now, what are the issues that could be understood within this framework? Of course, they are not about 2 years now, 3 years of debate about the reform of the IMF and international financial architectures. But very few decisions have been made, only technical issues, very specific. But under and beyond those issues, this much deeper debate containing calls for a change in doctrine went forth. The pending issues, I think, are the following, and I just want to sketch them in order to let them for the discussion and also certainly for the other speakers to take them. The first is refocusing. Of course, those models piled up together are coming from different periods. And different times in the history of the international monetary system should not coexist for a long time now. And the idea, of course, is refocusing on the fourth model, that is a model of international systemic crisis manager for the world economy and essentially for the world financial system. But how much? What are the facilities to be discarded in order to refocus on other ones? What are the design of the new facilities in order to organize on a permanent basis a model of systemic crisis manager? In order to understand that, we should go theoretically to the basic features of a model of systemic crisis manager that has been developed finally in the national context and which is now considered as a consensus in the most sophisticated countries. I think there are three characters, three features in a crisis management system. The first is the function of the lender of last resort in order to forestall liquidity crisis. Pure liquidity crisis. The second is private sector involvement in order to alleviate the losses related to solvency problems. And the third one, and related to this private sector involvement, is the authority of a public entity, a public body, essentially the state, in the big countries that could strike agreement to share losses, sharing losses, agreement of loss sharing, to restructure the failed financial institution and to change the debt profile by collective action. So those three features are really integrated into a system of crisis prevention and management. But the problem is that they are very difficult to develop internationally, and they set all the problems, raise all the problems we have. The first, for instance, the question of prevention. Prevention means surveillance. In the fourth model, surveillance means essentially looking at financial vulnerability. Or the IMF, look at very different issues with when it monitors the structural adjustment process. It looks at issues in the labor market, at issues in the product market, at how competition was enhanced or not in different countries. That's absolutely nothing to do with a question of crisis management. And so refocusing the scope of action is also redesigning surveillance process. But what does financial vulnerability mean? Financial vulnerability means for the IMF, which doesn't have all the expertise to do that, something new, that is institutional cooperation with other institutions, for instance, the Forum of Financial Stability, the national supervisors, the banking committee in Basel, and so on. But that is for the change in procedures. It goes very far. But if you have a change in content, what is to be looked at in financial vulnerability? The idea, the best would be macroeconomic financial stress, test stress, in order to link. But we know where we should go. We should go in the Article 4 examination of countries by the IMF to a linkage between the examination of financial vulnerability and the macroeconomic issues that the IMF really expert to do. In order to go to a macroeconomic assessment of the financial tensions and their probability that a systemic crisis could occur. An intermediary step, of course, is to make a macroeconomic balance sheet by aggregating the balance sheets of the financial institutions in a meaningful way. And this comes to the fact, of course, of more and better reporting of information. So surveillance has to be deepened a lot. And what is very interesting is the linkage between finance and macroeconomic dynamics in order to get a view about the systemic risk. The second problem, that is a very tough issue. The second one, I think, is a private sector involvement on the creditor side. The first one goes essentially on the debtor side. Even if information is drawn from creditor institutions. But private sector involvement, with private sector involvement comes the issue of standstill in payments when a crisis occurs. The question is about the coverage of standstill. I think not only public debt, because now crises come from the private sector, so the debt of the corporate sector and the banking sector should be brought into an eventual standstill. That is a very important problem. And the second is also the range of creditors that are involved. The only thing that have worked up to now are banking consortia in order to keep credit line open when very stringent liquidity shortage within the banking sector. But a broader consortia involving other agents than banks and commercial banks have not been developed in the previous crisis. So the question is a question of type of debt, of creditors, and how to make a standstill work. Why is a standstill important? Of course, what is the alternative of a standstill and restructuring with loss sharing? The alternative is what happened in, for instance, in Mexico. That is, across the board, socialization of losses by huge amounts of public money, and we are back to the third model. So if we want to get rid of the third model and go back to the fourth, standstill are absolutely necessary. A standstill should be declared by the debtor's government, but certified by the IMF. That is the proposal that makes the best sense, because if the IMF certifies standstill, the private sector can say that it is credible. How can it certify? Of course, first formally, but essentially in providing bridging loans, because certifying a standstill means declaring that the government, the debtor government, is negotiating in good faith. And so when the IMF certifies that, it can strike afterward. The government can strike with creditors. Loss sharing agreement in order to be able to restructure the debt profile and come back to a debt profile that is sustainable after the crisis. So it's a complex mechanism, and this complex mechanism, of course, right now the private sector doesn't want that, because the question is, should it be voluntary or should it be mandatory? Of course, the private sector wants it to be only voluntary, but pure voluntary, and I think the U.S. Treasury prefers also that. The European Union preferred mandatory restraint about that. But the question now is the free rider problem, of course. Pure voluntary standstill cannot work, and they even did not work when you have only a consortium of banks. A referee, a public agent that can put together and put its authority between the banks where necessary, even, for instance, for the LTCM rescue. It was not a pure voluntary, and it was the best condition for that, but it was not a pure voluntary phenomenon. And finally, I come to the last issue. Maybe it's end. I have two minutes. That's all right. The emergency facility for lending interest result. If you have streamlining of the facilities because we want to focus on the fourth model and get rid of all the extended facilities, systemic facilities, and so on of the third model, the model of financial intermediation, because we need that, we say that emerging countries have now access to capital. The question is their credibility and not their capacity to have access. So the emergency facility for lending distress reserve is the most important one. The question is very interesting because a facility in emergency for a quasi-lender first resort intervention means something very different from conditionality. So a pillar of the IMF action will have to be changed, because conditionality comes with negotiation of a program of reform with criteria of performance and commitment of the countries, and afterwards the facility comes in different steps. But here we need, if we really have a liquidity crisis, we need instant backing, instant flows of funds. And in an emergency situation that was not expected, because if it has been expected, there wouldn't be a liquidity crisis. Conditionality doesn't work. So there is here a very big issue. Some people want pre-qualification instead of conditionality. That is, the IMF would be a lender of last resort for this kind of global crisis coming from the deterioration of liquidity in specific markets, but only for countries that have pre-qualified. And this pre-qualification comes from very tough conditions that have nothing to do with the financial crisis at all. For instance, Calomiris wants some subordinated debt. Metzler wants the foreign banks to be free to come into the country. That is completely intrusive politically. It has nothing to do with the question, because no one has demonstrated that foreign banks would be less vulnerable than domestic banks to a financial crisis, of course. So it is impossible, I think, to go to this kind of pre-qualification that violates, of course, universality principle. And so it is in enforcing the importance of surveillance, enforcing financial surveillance, that the problem of moral hazard should be tackled with that. And after with that, the question, the second question and the last one I will raise is how it could be financed, this crisis facility, because it needs a very elastic supply of funds, an instantaneous supply of funds, and the IMF is not now has not this kind of resource. So the proposals made by some people, and I am sympathetic with that, is coming back of the SDR in the function of international lender of last resort by issuing a special issue of SDR in order to back up facilities that can intervene immediately in time of market liquidity crisis that would come to widespread contagion if it's not tackled immediately. So that's very interesting, because it means that the principle of international monetary principle could come by the back within the function of quasi-function of international lender of last resort. So what are, I think those are some of the big issues at stake. Right.
Michel, thank you very much. I should have said at the beginning in introducing Michel Aglietto that he's from the University of Paris, but then you might have guessed that listening to him. Michel has put forward a model, if we like, for a reform of the IMF to be able to be the agency for the management of to providing global governance, becoming a manager of systemic crises. But then it would have, he said, three requirements. It must have surveillance capability, and it must also have a surveillance capability looking at the right things. It must be a public agent which can organize private sector involvement. And then it has to have the means of acting in an emergency as lender of last resort. And he outlined at the end the difficulties which arise there. Right, so that's set an agenda. I'll now turn to Stefan Collignon from the German Ministry of Finance. Stefan.
Well, thank you, John. And let me also say that it would be rather boring if I would speak here simply as a bureaucrat of the German Ministry of Finance. So I'd rather claim to speak as someone who is a member of the faculty of the Free University in Berlin. At least it adds a little bit of spice and gives me more freedom. Having listened to what Michel said, I thought, my God, it's really complicated to set up a global government just to deal with financial crises. And I would like to take a step back for a moment and more look at governance before we set up the government. And I'm very much encouraged to do that by the outline that Meghnad Desai gave us at the beginning of the conference, where he really asked questions about the paradigms from which we operate and how we analyze what is happening in the real world in front of our eyes. And in that outline that we first got, there was one question that I thought was really great. It was the question, what is the nature of the global economy? And I have an answer which isn't as banal as it sounds. The nature of the global economy is that it is a monetary economy. And what does that mean? It means that money is the budget constraint. That means money has to be scarce relative to other resources. And given that the ultimate resource is labor, it really means that labor is less than scarce. It is superfluous to some degree, and therefore unemployment of these resources are a systemic necessity of a monetary economy. Of course, the question then is, how much of that surplus do we need? Is it 10 million or 40 million unemployed, or only one? But nevertheless, that is the question that is to be asked about how a monetary economy is managed. And of course, the answer to a lot of that depends on ideological a priorities, that's to say, values and social criteria that we apply to our analysis. Now, why I would like to insist on the monetary economy is because the usual classical, neoclassical paradigm of an exchange economy really has a different logic, because it is barter, ultimately, that is the essence of it. And it is based on three axioms. The first is markets are cleared by the price mechanism, which of course means by relative prices, and that is the ratio of marginal utilities. So what we are looking at is the utility of goods. Secondly, output and production are determined by labor and capital supply, and hence unemployment is just a distortion of the price mechanism, and we need to correct these distortions by creating sufficiently flexible markets for these two resources, capital and labor. And with that, we would have an economy that is, so to say, crisis-free. And the third one is that money comes in basically to determine the absolute price level exogenously, and that means also that profits depend on real wages, and that's where it links back in with the labor market. Now, I wonder if that is really the proper description when we consider that money is not distributed by helicopters but created endogenously as credit money, because then really it is out of the relationship between debtors and creditors that it appears, and therefore we then have to look at wages rather as the anchor to stabilize price levels and therefore also ultimately the nominal elements, that's to say the financial system. So profits and that which makes the economy tick are then really dependent on the difference between, on the one hand, the supply side, that's to say unit labor cost and capital cost, and on the other side, that means the cost of credit, and this is where the financial institutions come in, the financial markets have the prime role in such a society, and on the other hand, on the demand that is determined by the amount of credit and money supply that comes out of that. So really, what that means is that in a monetary economy, the crucial element is the capital markets. It is the comparison between real return and monetary returns. It is, so to say, Tobin's Q, rather than how labor markets operate and everything that's related to the flexibility and rigidity of markets. Well, that is my alternative proposition that I would like to put forward. And why do I make this paradigmatic excursion here? It is because what that really means is that financial stability is at the very heart of the global economy. It means financial crisis and financial instability are really the malfunctioning of the capitalist economy. And that means also that it is not so much the structural rigidities, the distortions of these capital and labor markets or goods markets that are at the heart of the crisis elements that we get. But what that also means, of course, is that under those circumstances, we have to look at the policy implications that allow the system to function, to be sustainable, and financial crisis is really a disturbance of the sustainability of the monetary system. So that means really that the global economy, like any monetary economy, requires following certain rules that are inherent to the monetary economies, like what Searle called the constitutive rules of a system. And I would say, let's say, four elements of those rules. The first one is that it's about credit and trust. And it means that you need to maintain the credibility and financial assets in order to keep the economy working correctly. Because ultimately, someone has to be willing to hold the promises that people give, which is a financial asset. Secondly, it is about preserving the stability, and that means ultimately price stability, because it is nominal assets. Financial assets are nominal. So it's about maintaining price stability as a fundamental rule of any monetary economy. And that stability has two dimensions. One is, of course, domestic stability, price stability at home. And here, the crucial element, given that in that kind of explanation money is endogenous, is the wage formation, what Keynes would have called the wage unit. And therefore, wage formation and the social consensus around that is really at the heart of maintaining domestic price stability. On the other hand, the second dimension of price stability is external price stability. Like a friend of mine, Heiner Flassbeck, used to say, it's a price stability in time and space. And that means it's about the exchange rate. And I think it is not by coincidence that what we have seen, that since the end of the system of Bretton Woods and when many countries went to free floats and flexible exchange rates, we have seen a continuous tendency that occasionally got disrupted, whereby countries would start to create fixed exchange rates amongst groups of companies. I have called that in some papers block floating. And then you had some anchor currencies like the Deutschmark in Europe against the dollar in other parts of the world, which had the flexible exchange rate between these key currencies, but around those you had blocks. And it created additional instability because the fundamental exchange rate between these key currencies become more unstable by the larger you make the currency blocks around that. An interesting element of that analysis is that when you have a single currency, you are actually abolishing the destabilizing effects of currency blocks. So the creation of the euro, in that sense, is actually a stabilizing event for the world economy. Just as the logic of creating a single currency for the single market is, in my view, an indispensable counterpart to having a well-functioning monetary economy. The third element, or the third aspect of it, is that if you are saying that the economy is constituted by rules, it implies obviously also that you need rules that bind, and let's not forget that bonds are about a binding promise, and that means also you need to regulate markets. The question is just how you do it, and that's where what Michel Aglietta said was important. And the fourth element of that is sort of the widest and the broadest of it all. When you're saying this economy is dependent on constitutive rules, they need to be put and placed into a larger set of social rules and that create these social facts and make them sustainable. And that means that there's a normative dimension to such an economy, the global economy, thereby extending the norms of a monetary economy. And you get a lot of social clashes about these normative factors in economies, in countries, in societies that have been working on a different logic in the past. And I think one crucial element in that, of course, is the rule of law, simply already because you couldn't have the debtor-creditor relationship, which is essential for the creation of endogenous money. But behind that also, it means that if you have individual debtor-creditor relationships, you need to protect the individual, and that ultimately means you need to also set up a system of human rights that command respect. So actually, I would say the capitalist economy necessitates human rights, as the ultimate rule that makes it function and sustainable. So this is a rather broad view of what it is, what is the nature of the global economy and where we go, but maybe it is sometimes useful to look a little, step a little bit back and look at this kind of the picture and the foundations on which we operate and then create our international global government.
Right, Stefan, thank you very much. So Stefan has broadened the view and has asked us to look at the nature of the monetary economy, the importance of credibility, of price stability, essentially the value of money, of the regulation of markets, and then the extension in the global economy of norms, some degree of standardization of what money is and what monetary transactions might be. And he suggested that in the process of globalization, some of the, there might be clashes as those norms are exported from one part of the globe to another as part of the process of monetary integration. But most especially, I think, I'd like to bring out of his talk the stress on the credibility of money in financial stability, in the sense that when we're looking at financial risks, we know what happens in a financial crisis is essentially there's a loss of belief or loss of credibility in some financial assets, some individuals, or perhaps in some form of money. And it's therefore the collapse of that credibility, which Michel wants to shore up with his surveillance procedures and lender of last resort, which is the key, it lies at the center of global financial crises and consequently in policy terms of global governance. Right, I'd like to now turn to Karen Lissakers, who is the US Executive Director at the IMF and therefore in many ways at the sharp end of the issues which have been raised so far. Karen.
Thank you. well, this has been a very interesting conference. So far, it focuses on many of the issues that we grapple with and try at least to resolve through the executive board, which is the proxy for all the member 182 member countries of the institution. it's a 24 member board. I guess we are an example of global governance for better and worse. I'd like to. Well, Stefan Collignon certainly broadened the scope of the discussion, but I what the institution tries to do in both crisis prevention and crisis management certainly is informed by the concepts he laid out, the need for trust, financial price stability, regulation, a rule of law, in effect, for financial and economic transactions, and extending norms through the global economy. If I understood you, one way of putting it is that globalization is really the process of extending those rules and those norms throughout the world, which is self-mutual, collective self-defense in a way, because as many speakers said in the earlier discussions, the financial crisis clearly no longer isolated incidents for a single country, but almost invariably have international, maybe global implications, as we've seen in the 1990s.
Could you put the mic a little closer to...
Sure, sorry. I'd like to comment on two areas. One is IMF reform, but before I come to that, just to touch briefly on the broad question that was posed in the letter of invitation to the conferees, which is were the financial crises in Asia, Brazil, and Russia in the late 1990s a harbinger of a new era of global international financial stability? I think it's pretty clear if one studies financial history that the world is replete with financial crises, and as several speakers pointed out this morning, the world at the beginning of the 21st century really looks more the way it did at the beginning of the 20th century than it did in the middle third of the 20th century, when governments essentially ran the global economy and controlled financial capital flows. Some of us would view that as actually a digression from the norm rather than the norm, but that there's clearly no consensus on that point. But I would make a couple of points about the phenomena in the late 1990s. I would say in some ways those crises, as severe as they were and as damaging as they were to the countries most directly affected, they were in some sense not as bad as the debt crisis of the 1980s in a couple of ways. First of all, the Latin American debts and potential defaults were really a dagger pointed at the heart of the banking system in the major industrial countries, in that many of our premier institutions had many multiples of their capital exposed, and if they had had to recognize those losses immediately, they would have been wiped out with enormous damage to not just to the debtor countries, but to the creditor country economies, to the real economies. Second of all, you had a very different progression of the crisis in Latin America than we've seen in both Asia, Russia, and Brazil the second time around, in that the Latin American crisis led to a protracted recession, very deep recession, really a decade of economic stagnation. For Latin America and for many emerging markets, Asia being an exception. Whereas now we have seen a very rapid recovery of both growth, of financial confidence, and a regained private financial flows. In the 1980s, Latin America really lost access, except negotiated access, to private capital, and continued to rely very heavily on official financing, to the point that their debt, external debt, actually doubled in that period. You've seen a very different phenomenon now. A quick recovery in Asia, Russia growing for the first time really since the end of the Marxist state. An ability of the debtor countries to repay very early. Mexico, Brazil, Korea have repaid the bulk of their official obligations very quickly. And I think one of the reasons, capital markets are seen as the villain in this story. I think there's a different way to look at it, which is that the capital markets, as opposed to the commercial banking markets, have a greater ability to allocate losses faster and to absorb losses faster, and there were huge losses. I don't know that anybody's put a number on them, but $100 billion is probably very modest. And they were recognized relatively fast through mark to market, through institutions failing, many capital markets institutions failing, and that the capital markets absorbed those losses without massive damage to the real economies in either the creditor countries. Not in the creditor countries, which has helped the economic. The fact that Europe and the U.S. continue to grow strongly has clearly helped the economic recovery in the crisis countries themselves, who have indeed suffered and continue to suffer very very large costs from the crisis, partly because the internal debt failures were heavily on the bank chassis, and that, as we know from our own problems, SNLs and the Scandinavian bank failures and so on, banking losses are much harder to resolve because bank liabilities are supposed to be carried at continuous real value, nominal value. But the quick recovery has not led to a complacency on the part of the financial authorities. There was some suggestion earlier today that the drive for reform of the international financial system has faded in the wake of this beginning of a recovery in the crisis countries. I think that's simply not true. If you look at the G7 communiques and you look at what has been coming out of the discussions evident in the annual meetings of the bank and the fund, there's been a continued and sustained effort to assess the lessons of this crisis and to try to build in corrective measures. And there have been, the IMF is certainly central in this process. It's not the only institution in play, but I think there have been a number of very important reforms in the institution. And one is the question of how we approach surveillance, and I thought that Mr. Aliette is quite right when he says there's a legacy of cumulative models and processes in the fund, and that have overburdened both our surveillance and program design, and we are trying to pare those back and trying to focus on what is really essential for the mutual insurance function and for the systemic crisis management responsibilities of the institution. There is much more focus now on financial vulnerabilities, on trying to assess the national balance sheets, if you will, and to improve member governments' own liability management, debt management. There is an effort to get more and better data faster and to have it publicly available. There are two disciplines in that, one for markets and the other for policymakers. It's a lot harder for them to fool themselves about what their situation is if they have to report every week on their short-term liabilities, or monthly, which is the data standard that we have set. We have put much more focus on the health of the domestic banking sectors in member countries, because as we found out and saw in Asia and in other cases, the deposit liabilities of the domestic banks are the contingent liabilities of the state, of the government. And you may not be aware that you have a fiscal imbalance, but you may indeed, it's on the bank's balance sheets, not on the government's balance sheets. We have, the fund is devoting not only surveillance, but an enormous technical assistance effort to help countries strengthen their supervisory systems and strengthen their banking institutions. And there's growing interest in, people talk about the fund being intrusive. There is so much demand for this service from the fund that we don't have the people to meet the demand. The fund draws a lot of expertise from accounting firms, from other central banks, and so on. But it is a very large activity. The World Bank is also engaged in this, and I think a very important step in strengthening the increasing the robustness of the international economy, international financial system generally. There is a whole codes and standards exercise, which sounds sort of boring, but it really is trying to get international agreement on these norms that you spoke about, and then trying to codify them, and then encouraging member countries to adopt them and to adhere to them. Professor Goodhart said earlier today, well, promulgating codes isn't that difficult. You only get a few smart people in the room and you can do it. Well, but intelligent people disagree. It may be, you know, there's a lot more agreement among Anglo-Saxons or Europeans and Americans about what the norm is for corporate governance, for example, minority shareholder rights and so on. Those principles were, I would say, not widely held or accepted in Asia. And those kinds of common standards and understandings are very important if you're going to have a lot of cross-border equity investment. So the codes and standards exercise, again, all of these things are voluntary, but again, are very important in trying to establish common norms for this monetary economy that you described. We have certainly learned that some exchange rate regimes are more susceptible to disruption than others. As you know, Secretary Summers is a very strong adherent of the corner solutions. You either float, or you have a firm peg where you are in effect locked in. The peg drives all other policies and imposes policy discipline. The problem with the intermediate regimes is that they create perverse incentives. If you have a managed or pegged rate in combination with an open capital market, the temptation for overexposure by both creditors and borrowers, if there's a big interest differential between domestic borrowing and foreign borrowing, becomes overwhelming, and you set yourself up for a big crisis. The floating exchange rate is certainly a better shock absorber in times of stress. And I think the central banker of Mexico wakes up and thanks his lucky stars every morning after Brazil blew up that the peso was floating and it didn't have to worry about pegging it and holding it. You will have seen that I think in the last couple of years, 14 countries have gone from this managed peg to more of a clean float. In the fund on conditionality, we have tried to turn conditionality on its head. We've created a new facility which provides ex ante conditionality, which says if you meet the agreed codes and standards and the data standard of transparency and you have developed good relations and communications with your private creditors, the fund will commit to a credit line in advance, and you will have access to that money if there is a problem very quickly without the usual hurdles and negotiations that the fund goes through. And I think that is it turns the whole process of conditionality and negotiating programs on its head. No one has used it yet. We've made some improvements, I think, in the facility during the last couple of months that I think there are indications of a number of countries being interested in this facility, and we will see if it serves its purpose, which is A, to provide insurance, and B, equally importantly, a strong incentive for countries to adopt good policies before they get into trouble rather than after. On crisis resolution, I'm sure there will be questions about standstills and so on. I mean, the main point is that there's very clear agreement that given the magnitude of the balance of payments crisis we've confronted recently, the private sector has to play a role. There are lots of disagreements about how that involvement should be brought about, whether it should be primarily voluntary or mandatory, and there should be some sort of hair trigger. The U.S. is certainly in the camp of leaning toward voluntary for the reason that Mr. Collignon mentioned, which is the issue of trust. The whole point of the rescue and financial crisis management, after all, is to restore confidence as quickly as possible and to restore the normal function of financial markets. Financial markets do not function if there is no trust, no confidence that obligations will be met, and we are therefore extremely reluctant to have some arbitrary trigger point that says, okay, that's it, now we abrogate contracts for the moment or we freeze them. No, we recognize that there may be instances when some sort of concerted approach, a non-market approach, will be necessary to get through a crisis, but that should be approached very, very carefully. We do support, and the fund has adopted a policy of lending into arrears, which is in effect saying the international community, official community, may provide financing even if a country is in a state of default on its private obligations. But as I say, it is an issue we think one has to treat with great care. The final piece of this reform construct is a review of our conditionality, which is not yet done, but that will be the challenge for the next few months. I think all of these measures, I mean, the reality we face when we talk about governance of the global economy is we are confronted, globalization requires integrated financial markets require an integrated cooperative international policy response. But we have a world where sovereign states have the legitimacy and the legal right to implement solutions. So that this is the dilemma of global cooperation, that you have to find cooperative solutions among sovereign states. And that means dialogue. A voluntary approach and trying to build a consensus. And that's really the primary function of the International Monetary Fund. And that was the primary function and the need that John Maynard Keynes, among others, saw when the fund was was created, because he had seen the disaster of the late 1920s and 1930s, where there was no monetary, there was no institution to bring about a consensus approach to financial crises. Thank you.
Thank you. We're moving towards a consensus in these talks, although a consensus which is covering a wide range of different analytical positions. I was particularly struck by Karen's final remark that if we look at an integrated market, we need, in some sense, an integrated policy, and perhaps then we need integrated institutions to manage that policy. If one takes an analogy with a nation state has a regulator, a lender of last resort. If we now globalize our markets, we find that our regulators and lenders of last resort are trapped in irrelevant national boundaries, whereas the boundary of the market is international. And so we then have to say, okay, if we want an integrated policy, what would it look like? What would it look like in an ideal form? What would our ideal international regulator be? An international lender of last resort, and then we can work backwards and see how far we fall from the ideal and what roles actually are not played in the world today by the institutions that we have, or the roles which are performed rather imperfectly. And I was very struck by the common themes which are emerging about the needs for financial sector surveillance. The IMF is reinventing itself now as a financial sector surveillance organization. It's interesting that if you have surveillance and conditionality, then you also have enforcement, because people actually don't get the money unless they obey the rules that you want them to obey, including financial rules. But of course, that enforcement only applies to people who need money. It doesn't apply to those who don't. And it's also striking in Karen's discussion the way in which the fund has been willing to experiment, but these experiments at the moment seem to be, although the fund is experimenting, are moving forward rather slowly, like the development of ex-ante conditionality, which so far, as she pointed out, has had no takers. Well, let's move on then, and our final speaker is Anne Pettifer, who is the director of Jubilee 2000.
Thank you very much. I'm going to stand up, if that's okay. I want to begin by thanking Professor Desai for the honor of this invitation. I am but a humble activist and campaigner, and my speech will be infused throughout by a more passionate and emotional commitment to social justice than is considered decent by economists on the whole, either decent or appropriate by most economists. And it is therefore particularly generous of economists to have me here today in this hallowed academic institution. I want to just say in passing that I was struck by the title of this conference, Financial Crises and Global Governance. Why only governance? Why no reference to democracy? My friends in developing countries are deeply suspicious of this new word and discourse around governance. They regard the whole issue as a paradigm set by Western donors and TNCs doing what donors do so often in developing countries, separating the thing, governance, from the whole, democracy, democratic rights, and democratic responsibilities. This delinking of governance and democracy is, in my view, dangerous, implying as it does that one can have the part, good governance, without the whole, democratic rights and democratic responsibilities. Anyway, I want to concentrate in my contribution today on financial crises and responsibility for these crises, and to talk about, in general terms, Jubilee 2000's proposals for holding those responsible for crises to account, both to the market, but also to taxpayers and therefore to citizens. But before I do that, I just want to look at what we define as globalization, because I think if we want to talk about shaping the governance of globalization, we ought to know what it is that we're shaping. And I've been very unsatisfied by the definitions and descriptions of globalization that I have heard and seen. Professor Giddens, for example, talks about globalization in terms of increased communications and improved communications, increased and improved technological progress, and also in terms of a post-communist economy. And my friends on the left talk about globalization very much in terms of what corporations get up to, and are very unkind about these corporations and blame them for all the evils of globalization. I find these definitions of globalization deeply unsatisfying because they are, for me, a bit like describing the landscape without describing what it is that, what are the forces that shape the landscape. It's no good for me just to look at the landscape. I want to know what are the underlying forces that shape the landscape. I've just come back from San Francisco. And for me, globalization is a bit like San Francisco. If you stand on the Golden Gate Bridge and scan the horizon, the landscape is pretty good looking, really. It looks pretty dandy from there. It really looks dandy. But you cannot talk to a single Californian without being aware that there are volcanic eruptions underneath this dandy landscape, and that people are deeply worried about it. They're also very responsible about it. They've gone to great lengths to introduce regulations, to introduce rules about building houses and bridges and roads and so on, so as to minimize the damage which they know is coming. And I think we ought to approach globalization in the same way. Instead of just describing the landscape, we've got to be looking at what are the forces that underlie it. And of course, the key forces that underlie globalization is the liberalization of capital flows. Now, when people talk about globalization, they talk about it as inevitable, as a law of gravity, as if you like, a natural force that we can't be in control of. I disagree profoundly with this view. Globalization and the liberalization of capital flows is the result of deliberate decision making by G7 finance ministers and their leaders, by central bankers and by the officials of the IMF and the World Bank to deregulate and to liberalize capital flows. These have been very deliberate decisions, and it's those decisions which today are shaping the landscape of globalization. And the other view is that, of course, this landscape will never change. I don't believe that to be so, and I believe that as long as we think that, we will not be looking at the potential eruptions in the global economy. Now, we've already had major earth-shattering eruptions in the global economy, in Asia, Russia, and Brazil, and I think I detected slight complacency here on the platform today and in this afternoon session about the impact of these eruptions on people. We work with aid agencies, of course, in those areas, and we know about the devastation to ordinary people's lives. I was in Thailand in February, and I met with the advisor to the Prime Minister, who explained to me that Thailand, which has an economic output roughly the size of Massachusetts, is exporting something like $13 billion a quarter in debt repayments as a result of the Asian financial crisis. Now, 9 out of 10 of the foreign banks that very unwisely invested in Thailand before July 1997 have been bailed out, not by the IMF, and not by the World Bank, not by the private sector, but by the taxpayers of Thailand, who continue to pay the cost of that massive bailout. And so I think we ought to not be complacent about the cost of these forces to the poor people of these countries. Thanks to what I regard as the recklessness and irresponsibility of central bankers and finance ministers, speculators, gamblers have been freed up to bet and gamble on the international financial markets at a dangerously unsustainable rate. The notorious and misnamed long-term capital management fund, which is an example which is now out of date, but we know not what their counterparts are doing in today's markets, accumulated $1.2 trillion in notional positions on equity of just $5 billion. And it's not just me, or Jubilee 2000, that thinks these financial instruments and markets have become unsustainable. The IMF, in its latest reports on developments in the capital markets, thinks so too. It expresses what I can only describe as alarm in this latest report. it talks about its concern for what it calls over-the-counter derivatives, the over-the-counter derivative markets, markets with no formal structures, no capital requirements, no rules governing conduct, and no rules that mutualize risks. Over-the-counter derivatives markets, says the IMF, may have changed the nature of systemic risk in ways that are not yet fully understood. There is concern that heavy reliance on innovative financial techniques and the possibility that they may create volatile and extreme dynamics could yet produce even greater turbulence with consequences of real economic activity, perhaps with consequences for real economic activity, perhaps with consequences reaching the proportions of real economic losses typically associated with financial panics and banking crises. It's not Jubilee 2000, this is the IMF in its report which was presented in Prague. For me, that's fairly strong language from the IMF, equivalent to the screaming, wailing sirens that would be heard in San Francisco on the brink of an earthquake. So the wealth of the financial sector of the global economy and the virtual explosion in lending and borrowing and trading in money during the 1980s stems from two radical changes made by central bankers and finance ministers. First, the deregulation of lending and borrowing on international markets, and second, government or taxpayer protection of international creditors when things go wrong. In other words, the nationalization of losses made by bankers' investors and the transfer of these losses to taxpayers. Not just the taxpayers of the United States, the United Kingdom, and of the West, but also the taxpayers of Mexico, Brazil, South Korea, and Thailand. So there's a real concern that we have that these debacles socialize, as the professor said, losses and transfer them to the poor. We are also concerned that the institutions that administer international finance, that oversee international financial arrangements, are themselves not open to the forces, to the private market forces that they themselves commend so heartily to others. And I'm thinking here of the IMF and the World Bank. The IMF and the World Bank are protected institutions, protected by the safest credit risks in the world, the treasuries of the United States, the United Kingdom, Japan, France, Germany. These are protected institutions that can make errors in the international financial markets, but would not necessarily suffer losses for these errors because taxpayers bail them out. They bail them out on a number of occasions, and they bail them out, for example, in the debt crisis, which I could talk about at much greater length. So what we have is bailouts, or what Karen has called insurance, and this, in our view, increases the possibility of moral hazard in the international financial system. It doesn't decrease it; it increases it. Because some people would argue that these kind of bailouts are necessary for stabilizing the international financial system. We disagree very profoundly. We think the insurance that Karen has talked about, the bailouts that have been talked about, induce moral hazard. They increase the possibility of future reckless lending and borrowing by protecting those engaged in free market lending, and they will lead to more suffering, to more crises, and to more grief. And the main causes of these future crises will be the double economic standards that underpin the globalization process. We are told that it's about the reign of free markets, about the spread of free markets to the global economy, about the benefits of such trade and capital market liberalization. We disagree. Globalization is about protectionism for the rich. In the European Common Agricultural Policy, for example, in the United States, subsidies and protections for its industries, and in Japan, subsidies and protections for its industries. So it's about protectionism for the rich and free trade for the poor. It's about subsidies for rich country farmers and the removal of subsidies for farmers in indebted nations. It's about the privatization of poor country assets and the nationalization of rich country losses. Globalization, as far as we can see, is about the transfer of wealth from the poor to the rich. We want to see a more realistic link made between the IMF and the countries in which it works. We believe that the IMF, when it makes bad loans, whether those loans are to Suharto, to Mobutu, to Yeltsin, or to Marcos, that they don't suffer the kind of losses that the Swiss banks suffered, for example, when they made bad loans to Robert Maxwell. When the Swiss banks lent to Robert Maxwell and woke up one day and found that he was not there anymore and that his business was corrupt, they faced severe losses. And when they charged the sons of Robert Maxwell with liabilities, they were told by the courts that the sons who had been directors on the board enjoyed something called limited liability. In the case of the Congo, in the case of the Philippines, in the case of Indonesia, the sons and daughters of Marcos, of Suharto, and of Mobutu do not enjoy limited liabilities for the losses imposed on them by their corrupt elites and by the people that lent to them. They enjoy unlimited liabilities for those losses. Now, we think that it's important that as a precondition of the free market, it is important that economic gains should not be delinked from economic risks, then the bank and the fund who make economic gains should also take risks and should also make losses. But because the bank and the fund are dominated by creditors, 45% of the votes on the boards of the bank and the fund are the votes of the most powerful creditors, the G7, and 41 of the most indebted nations on the board of the bank and the fund have only got 3% of the votes. Because the bank and the fund are dominated by creditors, it's always creditors' solutions which are put in place. So we in Jubilee 2000 believe that we need a new insolvency process, an international financial insolvency process. We're struck that when Macy's or Eurotunnel goes bust, then the children and grandchildren of the employees of Macy's and Eurotunnel are not expected to meet the losses brought about by mismanagement. But when a country goes bust, the losses are effectively transferred to the taxpayers. We want to put an end to that system. We want a system whereby both creditors and debtors are disciplined for the losses that are made in international financial markets. The way the system works at the moment, it is the debtors that are disciplined, largely, and not the creditors. Now, how can this be brought about? We have three proposals. The first proposal is that we need to cancel debts. The cancellation of debts is in itself a form of discipline. It punishes debtors, it punishes lenders who've made bad loans, and it warns creditors that have made bad loans, and it warns debtors that they may not be able to borrow again quite so easily because the debts have been written off. This is a form of discipline, and that's why we call for the cancellation of debts. We want an international insolvency process which will be managed not by creditors but by an independent receiver, so to speak, pretty much in the way in which Germany's debts were written off in 1953 when Hermann Joseph Apps, a banker, determined that Germany could not repay her debts until she had a trade surplus and that even then she should never spend more than 3% of her GDP on debt repayments. That was an extremely generous settlement, settled by an independent banker who then went on in 1971 to Indonesia and made a similar settlement for Mr. Suharto, found in favor of the debtor effectively and forced losses on the creditor. We want an institution, a simple institution, not a complicated institution, a group of individuals who can act independently of the creditors, the IMF and the World Bank, private creditors as well as official creditors, and the debtor on the other hand. And finally, we want, as part of an improvement to global governance, a change in the voting system on the board of the IMF and the World Bank. The institution has to be transformed to become more representative of its members, to become more representatives of the nations who are debtor nations, and not simply dominated by those which are creditor nations. Those are our probably somewhat simplified proposals for changes. But they are based on the notion that we want justice in the international financial system. We believe that the whole process of globalization has undermined the ethical, spiritual, and if you like, moral underpinnings of our societies, and that we want these ethical, moral, and spiritual dimensions to be returned to the way in which we talk about the international financial system. We don't want it to be discussed simply as a monetary economy which floats somehow above and detached from and delinked from these profound moral issues. and we want to see structural changes which will introduce greater justice between both debtors and creditors. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Anne. If I could characterize what Anne had to say within my model, which I put before she spoke, that is, if we take national institutions and now we globalize, can we have international institutions which perform the same role? I think it fits into what she had to say. National institutions are accountable, at least they are in democracies, whereas do we have a degree of accountability which actually affects the institutions which we have to manage the international economy? Perhaps the recklessness that she referred to of finance ministers and central bankers derives from the process of liberalization without the development of that accountability, without the structure of institutions to manage financial markets in the way which they were managed in national economies. And it is also striking, if we look at national economies, that national economies do have systems of insolvency, to which she referred towards the end, in the sense that in a national economy you do have insolvency laws, and insolvency laws exist to take away debt because debt has been seen as a consistent burden on the operations of national economies. When we extend our perspective to the international economy, these structures for resolving problems of indebtedness are extremely limited or don't exist at all, and therefore we have debt burdens which persist for a long time, but having a very considerable deflationary effect on national economies and on the international economy as well. So it seems to me that our four speakers have operated within actually a similar framework. They're all looking at the issue of we had institutions which worked in national economies when national economies were relatively segregated, as they were under Bretton Woods, buttressed by capital controls. And with globalization, we have not managed to solve the issue of what sort of institutions could manage that international economy. Karen sees us groping towards them. She sees the IMF's experiments moving in that direction. Michelle has a very strong vision of how the IMF might be able to play that role. Anne is saying that there doesn't exist either the accountability or the structures which would allow the IMF to play that role, and therefore it is, for her, fatally compromised. And the role that needs to be played was sketched out by Stefan in his image, or his picture, of how a monetary economy works. So you had four speakers who've laid out for you some vision, individual pictures of the problems of the international economy, and it's now your chance to question them. And I'll take questions from the gallery as well as from down in the floor. When you stand up to ask a question, just do say what your name is so that we can respond in a direct and personal way, and you're not just an anonymous questioner. Right, who would like to start? There's anonymity in sense of sight. Oh, yes, good. The gentleman in the red sweater.
My name is Troy Davis. Are you?
Yep.
My name is Troy Davis from the World Citizen Foundation and Secretary of the Campaign for World Democracy. I'm very happy with what the panelists said, because it really, the conclusion, it seems, that what we really need is a new model of how to scale up democratic structures from the nation state up to the global level. This was said by Stefan, I'm sorry, I don't know your last name, and also by Anne, who basically opened her speech by saying that what is missing is the dimension of democracy. Because governance is a very loose concept, but we have to figure out what type of governance. And if we had more democratic type of governance, then if we could create the accountability that we need to create the trust, which is the basis of the global financial system. So I believe that what the question we should ask ourselves is how we create democratic institutions, which can be directly accountable, so that there is a trust, so that there is a framework. If we, for instance, create a global insolvency law, for instance, well, who's going to do it? Who are those people, this independent agency, who are they going to be accountable to? Well, maybe there should be, we should see, we often have elections, direct elections. We ought to create some kind of world parliament or something to which all those bodies are accountable to, and therefore which will create, which is more democratic than the existing structure of the IMF. And this, of course, has to be negotiated so that neither the rich countries nor the poor countries will have the upper hand. But this is really a matter of, which should be put on public agenda, how to really create those democratic institutions on a global level.
Thanks very much. Any final comments on this? Roy Choi has made a statement. Okay, let's move on. Thank you, Troy. Yes.
I'm Roy, I'm a researcher at NSA. I'd like to follow up the previous speaker. I'm very encouraged well by what the speaker's been saying. But it strikes me that there needs to be a degree of pragmatism, a sort of physical pragmatism in what's being proposed. And I think one thing that would help is that if people were more supportive and both on the activist side and on the sort of economic side of the sort of national politicians understand the pressure that they are under and that they face, and that if it is actually the institutions that develop the sort of frameworks are there in many cases, that individual countries are able to be members of the IMF, there obviously could be a levelling out of power, I guess you could say, within that body, so it's not heavily skewed as it is at the moment. But I understand that these things don't sort of change overnight and a move towards them. And also a move towards these bodies actually politically debating and agreeing the rules, which are then applied by the people who work professionally within the bodies, is a sort of way to go. And if people understood more that that was the way to go, so the institutional framework first of all, and then start talking about the particular problems and how to solve them, things might actually progress more positively.
I'm struck that the first two speakers said they were encouraged. I must say I was rather depressed by because in a way what everybody on the platform presented was the scale of the problems which they're facing. But I was also struck because the IMF is, after all, a treaty organization which is accountable to the states which signed the treaty. That is a structure of international accountability. Whereas, for example, the Bank for International Settlements, whose committees set capital adequacy requirements around the world, is not accountable to anybody. Right. Oh, sorry, let's have people on the platform first. Michelle?
No, we should have...
No, I think John put the problem rightly. World democracy as aware of the procedures are within Western nations is not at reach for right now and for a long time, especially because it is not widespread worldwide. Independent entities, for entities who are really who have a strong role in global governance, I think is something dangerous also. So it is right that the IMF is an intergovernmental body. And I don't think that for the time being it's something better can be devised than intergovernmental body. The fact is that the IMF doesn't work actively and as the political guidance is exactly what the charter of the IMF is all about, meaning that, as Anne said, all the big decisions had been made essentially by the G7. So the first move could be changing the external and internal political governance in the IMF and with the IMF. External governance means the emerging the countries that acquire more economic power and financial power in the world should, of course, have larger quotas and a larger say in political decisions. So the first move could be changing in quotas and also changing the circumscriptions that make people who are not large enough to gather and have a say within the decision. These circumscriptions are absolutely very odd now because they have been made just in the beginning at the, when the fund was founded, and they have not been changed, of course. For instance, Switzerland, I think, represents the interest of Turkmenistan or something like that. The circumscription should be changed in order to take account, I think, of the monetary groupings that and arrangements that are regional now. And so regional groupings, for instance, in Asia, with, of course, also in Europe, could be could have stronger influence if they are put together, and so if there is a reform in the circumscription. But we need also a change in the internal structure of the IMF, that is changing the interim committee has changed the name, but it has not changed at all its focus and its political influence. It is not a political entity or political council with high officials responsible at a high level that could make the strategic decisions. So the strategic decisions are made outside the fund and applied by the board and applied by the director, the general director. And so and this council is something that is within the charter, and it should been created at the beginning, but the U.S. Treasury opposed it. And so the change in quota, the change in circumscription, and the creation of a real political body that could put the strategic decision within the fund and not outside it could be a step, I think, in the right direction.
Okay, let's actually go to the floor, and then we'll have some more people from the meeting. Yes, sir. Yes, you.
There's a woman up there.
Okay, right. Yes. You, sir, at the back. Yes.
I was looking at the constitution of the IMF and the World Bank. The president of the World Bank must be American, and the director of IMF, Director General, must be European. Can you tell me why?
I think people regard your question as making your point. There was a lady up here, was it? Yes. Right. The question is, for those below the balcony who couldn't hear it, if the panelists could comment on the possibilities for regional monetary funds. Are you going to take that up?
I'd like to say that I think that they would be a very good idea. I was in Hong Kong when Japan proposed a regional monetary fund for Asia in 1990, just before the crisis, and was rebuffed, and I thought incredibly rudely and brutally, by the G7. But clearly that would have helped. And I think personally that more regional cooperation on these issues would be helpful.
Sure.
On this issue, I think the question is what is it that such a fund should do? And if it is just a sort of additional fund next to the IMF, I can't really see its usefulness. But I think your question points at something more fundamental. I have worked a lot on European monetary integration, and it seems to me that there have been very compelling arguments and important forces that have brought Europe back to a state, I mean the few offshore islands, but in general, that have under ships in trade and investment. And that is what first created the European monetary system and ultimately led to European Monetary Union. I think that a lot of the problems that we had in the 70s and 80s were related to the fact that we got the major oil price shock at a time when we had flexible exchange rates. I believe that Asia is actually facing somewhat a situation similar to the shock that we had in the 70s after the end of Bretton Woods within Europe. Of course, things are not exactly the same, and the degree of regional integration is not the same, the institutional cooperation isn't the same, and all that. But the implicit danger of highly volatile exchange rates for that region will be a break or a hindrance to economic growth. And so I would not be surprised, let's put it that way, if ultimately Asia would want to think about how to stabilize its own exchange rates. And that, of course, is then the context where such a fund could come up under a much broader exchange rate management procedure. If I may just say another word on this democracy issue, I want to shock you a little bit. I'm not convinced that democracy is the answer to it all. Let me talk as a German. Adolf Hitler was elected by the German people.
Not really.
Well, I think enough. Well, after all, he got enough votes to make it into power.
Yeah.
And
that is not.
Exactly, and that is my point. Democracy is not only about elections. That is exactly the point I want to make. And this is why in my talk before, I have very much looked at the issue of norms. I think we have to think about what are the vectors that transport norms of respect, something that I would embody in the concept of human rights. Respect for minorities and not just the majority in terms of democracy. So it's like, and then you have to look at what are the forces and the social norms and systemic norms that help to sustain that and elaborate it. I think that is more of the issue than just looking at who is voting where. And well, let me stop there, but I think that's behind it.
All right.
I really think this is
everybody going.
This is a very fundamental issue, and I'm really rather shocked by what has just been said. Of course, we all believe that democracy is not about elections once every 5 years, but I think the experience of Germany particularly sensitizes us to the need to build institutions that are responsive to citizens. To a wide range of citizens, and of course responsive to their human rights, not just their individual human rights, but their collective human rights. But I think it's the dismissive way in which financial managers and officials are now talking about democracy. It's the way in which governance is now talked about without a democratic framework that is scary. And what I'm talking about is about international institutions being accountable to governments, as the professor has said. The IMF has to be responsive to its members. I am not a supporter of the Republicans in Congress, but I do envy them their ability to get IMF officials to come and give evidence and to report to the Congress on progress, and also to challenge those officials by using the appropriation process. The British Parliament does not hold IMF officials to account in the same way as the American Congress. And I think that is a fundamental weakness of the international financial system. They should be responsive and accountable to the governments, to the taxpayers who finance them and who provide the underpinning which enables them to go out and borrow in the international market, which is a strengthening of national institutions and of democracies in sovereign within sovereign nations.
Right. Karen, you wanted to?
Yes, I certainly do. The governing body of the people talk about the IMF as if it is something separate and free-floating and independent of the governments, the shareholders that make all the decisions. The executive board is the decision-making body of the institution. It is accountable to the member governments. I am appointed by the President of the United States. I am confirmed by the United States Senate. I have been asked to testify. Some of my European colleagues testify before their parliaments. And we are the ones who make the decisions. It is not management, and it is not staff. And the institution is indeed subject to control by elected governments. Now, you could argue that institutions such as the fund should be subject to a different democratic governance structure, which would be a global parliament and a global government. I doubt very much at this stage that the majority of voters in most sovereign states would agree with that, would want to go in that direction. I thought the Danes had a view on this the other day. So, you know, this collection of representatives of sovereign governments is sort of the best we can do now in trying to move toward, as I say, what is necessary, which is cooperative solutions. And I think it is also a mistake to think that the G7 executive directors sit there and sort of just bull through everything in the board. That is not how the institution works. First of all, we don't even have a simple majority. And some decisions require a supermajority. For example, changing the pricing on loans requires a 70% majority. But the board works on consensus building. And I can tell you, we negotiate into the night to try to get agreements on both programs and on facilities and on broad structures that everybody can buy onto. And the African executive directors and the Middle East executive directors and Latin Americans, there is a lot of debate, a lot of negotiation, and the board is not the only forum. There's the G20, which was created specifically to have a different forum for debate with the key emerging market countries. The U.S. has massive cooperation with the Western Hemisphere finance ministers and regulators. There's a lot of cooperation, a lot of discussion. The BIS is bringing in the supervisors from emerging market countries and trying to come to a common understanding of what the governance, if you will, of what the common rules of the international financial system should be. So it is simply a caricature and a distortion of the reality that those of us who work in this area live with every day to suggest that there are sort of 7 finance ministers who just hammer the rest of the world into submission.
Right. Question, yes. Yes.
My name is Nick Eisen, and I work for one of the large international credit rating agencies. My question to any one of you refers to the private sector bail-in clauses, still, I believe, in their so-called experimentation phase. The first question, less important, I think, so I would ask you, what right does the IMF actually have to force countries to restructure their private debts? And the second one, which I think is far more important, this private sector bail-in, particularly in the case of Ecuador, as we've seen recently, has begun to create a perception that these moves to bail-in the private sector will be repeated more and more in the future. This, to my mind, actually harms the credibility of the country just as much as it does the credit. I'm thinking particularly of the small emerging market countries with significant needs for capital importation, who are now effectively shut out of capital markets as a result of IMF forcing Ecuador, for example, to restructure its private sector debt. I don't foresee that the private sector can touch Ecuador within 10 years now.
Aran, you sound as if you were very in favour of private sector bail-ins in your talk.
The case of Ecuador seems to me to illustrate how wrong the system is, that private sector creditors have had to suffer losses, whereas official creditors have continued to be repaid, and I think that is wrong. But I would like to disagree with the point that it's because of what the IMF has done in Ecuador that these countries are not creditworthy. They're not creditworthy because they're highly indebted and because they do not have the capacity to raise the foreign reserves to repay their debts. That is the reality. And that reality has been obscured by the fact that the IMF has, with its defensive lending policy, provided the finance for it to repay its debts, the bank and the fund, which has obscured the fact that actually countries like Ecuador do not have the capacity. Now, I think we've got to face economic reality. So do private creditors, and so do the governments of those countries. that actually, if they are to borrow on the international financial markets, how are they going to repay if their commodities are collapsing, the prices of their commodities are collapsing, their capacity to raise revenue for repayment is declining. Those are real issues, and they're not caused by the IMF at last facing economic reality in Ecuador. What I think is so iniquitous about Ecuador is that the reality that private creditors can't be repaid does not apply to official creditors. This is the unequal treatment of creditors in the international financial system. Ecuador continues to pay the IMF and the World Bank very large sums of money while private creditors are penalized. That is wrong. You know, Ecuador can't pay.
Karen, do you want to go?
Well, so what is your, first of all, Ecuador has been in default on sovereign debt for several years. One of the reasons one has limited sympathy for the private creditors who underwrote bonds after Ecuador was already in default on bilateral sovereign claims. The balance of payment support the fund provides is not just for debt servicing. I mean, these countries, you know, need to pay for imports. Would you propose, I mean, what is your alternative? Would you propose the fund say, sorry, Ecuador, you got a problem, take care of it yourself, because if we lend you money, you're going to have more debt, and gee, then, you know, I mean, what, I don't understand what your alternative system would look like.
We're simply saying that the bank
for Ecuador,
the fund and donors like the British government provide balance of payments support, which is not used for imports. It's used for the repayment of debt service, mainly to the bank and the fund, and then secondarily to official creditors like the Paris Club.
So what would you propose we do when Ecuador had its meltdown?
I repeat, we face the reality that these countries cannot pay their debts, and we take the losses because we've lent badly to them, the private sector as well as the official sector, and we write off the debts. But what does not happen is the debts do not get... Zambia, which is bankrupt, Sierra Leone, which is bankrupt, has just had £10 million of British grant aid money, which has not been used to build wells, water wells or hospitals in Sierra Leone. It's been used to repay Sierra Leone's public debts to the IMF and the World Bank in Washington. So we maintain the pretense that Sierra Leone, which is so bankrupt, which is so evidently bankrupt, can pay her debts, and we use taxpayers' money to finance debt repayments to the bank and the fund. That is crazy economics. It's not reality. And I'm saying face reality and write off the debt.
The private sector bail-in is a very popular policy in discussions today. Does anybody else want to take that up before we move on to another topic? The issue of private sector bail-ins. Yes.
Oh, sorry.
No. Do you want to talk about private sector bail-ins?
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
I want to point out the paradox that in the 1980s, when a lot of debt was private to commercial banks, it was possible, in the 1980s, when many countries had entered private commercial debt, we ran into a debt crisis. A lot of that debt was written off as bad debt. Banks write off debt all the time as bad debt. They know how to do it. And good banking involves knowing when you're not going to get something paid, if you write it off. Now, you know, some countries like Bolivia paid 15 cents to the dollar. Okay, it took a long time for the international community to devise the plan. But the paradox of public debt is, as Anne said, that nobody wants to cancel any public debt. Governments are not being sensible bankers. They're behaving like governments. And governments don't know anything about banking. Now, it could be easily possible, and had this been done long ago, this debt would not have mounted up either. Then we could have said, look, okay, we made mistakes, these people borrowed money, tough luck, commodity prices collapsed. We're not going to get this money back. Instead of we are in a charade in which we go on and on pretending that G7 is going to have some kind of plan to give these people money to pay back their debt, and then we'll give them more money to you know, I don't know what's going to happen if you cancel it instead of between giving money to Zambia to pay back to IMF, which will then pay back to us. It's a very great way of circulating money. I think it would be better if all public debt was equitized, privatized, and floating. That's what I'd like to propose, the floating of all public debt.
Pretty bonds.
And see what the market will pay for it.
Exactly. Less than 10%.
sincere system than what we got now. If I would just comment one thing about democracy, I think the problem with democracy, the United Nations and all the institutions they set up in 1944 are not democratic institutions. They're undemocratic. At the heart of the United Nations is inequality between the Security Council, veto holding power, and other powers. Now, you can't bear the cat. They don't want to give up their powers. They're not stupid. And these people don't even care about arms sales. They don't even respect human rights in their own territory. How are they living democratic? So I think rather than having democracy as an agenda, which is very nice, it makes people very warm. It's not going to happen. I'd rather say that let's look at accountability is one thing, and symmetry of voting is another. Accountability we have got the IRS and all that, but symmetry of voting you haven't got. The only institution that has got symmetry of voting is my favorite institution, the WTO, the only genuinely global institution. It was set up not in 1944, but in 1994, by which time the world had changed. And we recognize that 150 countries. And I think we'd rather insist, not that we have such a massive democratic upsurge in Ireland, but that we have equal votes.
Right. A paean of praise to the WTO from Professor Desai. Right, so you wanted to ask a question. Yes. No, the chap behind, and then you, and then the chap behind.
Gosh, freelance journalist and increasingly confused observer. I have a quick question, actually, about the Tobin tax. It strikes me that no one has even raised it, at least for the brief second, to dismiss it. Because, and I'm already aware of the potential to chase of arguments against it as to, you know, an inhibitor of the free international trade, and indeed the problem that maybe it won't serve as a deterrent. But I just suggest for the time being that even in spite of the possibility that it doesn't pose a deterrent, because after all, we talk about democracy often not as an end to itself, I think it has to be said that it's a means to greater distribution of resources, for just one example. So if we accept, you know, the host of disadvantages that the critics heap upon the Tobin tax as being a weak deterrent because people will go off to offshore markets, etc. Even if we accept that, because I find itself perhaps stupid, what does the panel think about the feasibility of the Tobin tax for generation of resources at the very least?
Okay. The Tobin tax, there's a question on the Tobin tax for those who didn't hear, and the questioner wanted to leave aside the difficulties of whether it will actually succeed in stopping short-term capital flows, which is the main purpose, or destabilizing short-term capital flows, minimizing them, but instead as raising a means of raising resources. For what, by the way? What are you going to do with these resources when you've got them?
Well, we're talking about, because one side of the coin is suspending the debt or floating the debt, dropping it, what have you.
Right.
On the other side of that coin is generating the resources that we can hope to begin generating after we finish circulating money.
Right. Okay, so it's resources which we used for development, essentially.
Right.
Right. Okay, good. So anybody on the panel want to comment on that aspect, Tobin tax?
I think we all agree, don't we?
I don't think we should combine two things that are basically different. The question of capital control for the well-functioning of the financial markets and the contribution of capital control to financial stability is one thing. And raising resources for development is completely another thing. Mixing both make the issue really more obscure and certainly less effective. Capital controls with the Tobin tax will certainly not stem any crisis because it is a flat rate, a rate that is very modest, and we know that the differentials in yield that trigger capital flows and capital inflows for high yield. You look at the G-cows, for instance, with
interest rate of about 80%, or even more than 100%, with the idea for the people who made investments exposure, big exposure there, that exchange rate would be guaranteed by the international community. There is absolutely no way that a flat tax could do something. So capital controls should be, I think, treated from the debtor side. From the debtor side, with another rationale. For the monetary sovereignty of the country. It means that capital control is certainly proper because the countries have to manage their own liquidity, and excessive capital inflows prevent the countries to manage their own liquidity. So from a simple monetary view, we should encourage the capacity of the countries to impose capital controls when they see fit. And the other rationale is prudential. We know very well now for a series of crises that excessive foreign indebtedness mixes a risk, mixes credit risk, foreign exchange risk, maturity risk, and so on. And it triggers systemic risk as a way those risks interact with each other. So for prudential issues, the countries should be able to impose some capital provision that could be increased or decreased and modulated with the extent of the dynamics that have to be forestalled, and so that could be that is flexible, and that could be made very, very effective for the creditors, because we could increase. If you put a 100% reserve ratio, you punish really those speculators who want to make investment there. So I think capital controls should be treated at the point of the flows of capital and modulated with the extent of the process. The raising of funds is something very different, and that I don't think that we should mix both.
One interesting issue there is, if the Tobin tax worked and you stopped short-term capital flows, then you'd have no resources. But then it doesn't work. That's the point that was made.
£50 billion
is
£50 billion
pounds is generated per year.
Yes, but
you mean you can generate resources?
The issue is whether you want to generate resources by a tax on short-term capital flows, which is very difficult to manage, or we want to do it some other way. Now, one then says, well, what's some other way? What are you talking about? But the political dimension of being able to introduce a Tobin tax may be much more severe than being able to actually agree to debt forgiveness, given the amount of success that Jubilee 2000 have had, and the steam, as a lobbying organisation, and the steam that's behind this. So they might actually be much more successful politically than trying to achieve something like that. Anyhow, I'm usurping my chairman right. I promised you, sir, that you would have a chance to ask, and then there'll be two more questions after you, sir. So everybody wants to get one in. Do think hard, catch my eye, so on and so forth. Yes, sir.
My name is Saurabh Garg. I'm a scholar at the European Institute in the LSE. When we talk of issues of global governance, very often we get restricted to free capital movements. There are a number of other issues, for example, of free trade flows. But then we are not willing to talk on the issues of agriculture subsidies in Europe or elsewhere. These are issues related to technology transfer, but they are associated with a patent regime. And there are issues related to labor mobility, but they are attached with labor standards. So I would just like maybe a comment from the panel on whether we are willing to discuss these issues other than free capital movement, but which impact global governance and globalization in the United States.
Right, Stefan.
Well, at least on the, I mean, trade flows and so on, obviously we all know trade theory and so on, so I don't want to really spend much time on that, but the labor standards actually fits in with what I'm saying about human rights. And as I would actually extend it or make clear what was implied in my previous remarks, I think ultimately if it's about norms, and if these norms are also in a way constituted by the structure of the economy we have, then clearly the conditionality that we impose on bailing out or whatever certain countries under certain conditions, the giving aid should be made subject to conditionality of human rights, or if you want to call it standards of democracy that include those human rights. And I think labor rights are an important part of that. So yes, I do believe that slave labor should not be part of what is allowed in the world, even if it helps to develop some countries, or that you should not have children work. And I don't think that that is really in any way in a contradiction with creating wealth. As a matter of fact, I would expect that it rather helps to the creation of wealth, including the countries where these standards get applied. So the bottom line is, conditionality of human rights should become an important part of global governance. And I think you need that, as John said, because you need to make countries sovereign states, somebody said earlier here today, that are based on consensus. You need to make them accountable to mankind, to the global community, because all too often sovereign states are hijacked by individual interests. And by creating that kind of global culture, I think we would improve both the economy and the world people live in.
Right. You, sir, up at the back, you had a question.
Yeah, my name is Michael DeBeer. I'm a supporter of Jubilee 2000. I have a follow-up question for the German professor. You're talking about vectoring norms. It seems to me that right now the way that the norms are vectors is that you have bureaucrats at the IMF and World Bank saying, I'm not going to submit your plan to the board of IMF for additional financing unless you nationalize your copper industry and reduce your health budget by 20%. And that's the sort of the vectoring of norms, of the taking away of power from national governments. So I was kind of wondering, what are you saying when you talk about the vectoring of norms? What norms are you talking about, and how are those going about?
Okay, for folks below the balcony who couldn't hear, the question was about the nature of norms and whether the norms that are being imposed, particularly, as the speaker said, by the IMF, take away power from national governments. And the question was addressed to Stefan.
Well, I wish we could discuss that in greater depth. We can't do that here. I wrote a paper which you might be interested to find on my personal webpage, which is called Why Do Poor Countries Choose Low Human Rights? Where I dealt with that issue of norms and the different societies. I think there are different logics according to which certain societies work. And in a monetary economy, there's a fundamental logic, which is that ultimately you need to have the freedom to contract. And debtor-creditor contracts are the essence of that freedom. Now, of course, that then gets all kinds of, after this general statement, you have to go into all kinds of manifestations of that. And when Anne, early in her speech, sort of started to attack the question of capital flows, I mean, the question that comes up to me is like, that is really about the freedom to make contracts. Because capital flows are not like a river that comes suddenly down on you. Capital flows are made because people make contracts about credits and somebody needs to keep their words, and sometimes this is pretty tough. So then the institutions like the IMF or whatever that come to sort of help out because we have a crisis, but of course implicitly it's a new contract you make. And the contract is subject to certain conditions. You can now argue always and in great details whether those conditions under which you are willing to establish that contract are good for the country or bad, and who bears the burden, and whether it is justified or not. And this is sort of part of the day-to-day management, but ultimately it's about that. It's about the freedom to make contracts rather than living in an economy, living in a society where the rule is about hierarchy, about a different way how you establish decisions.
Right. And you, sir, you had a final question.
Roger Palmer from UCLA. And I wanted to come back briefly to the question of democracy. And I wanted to say, I think, to Anne, that I agree with almost everything she said, with the exception of the characterization of what globalization is. And I think that underlying the fact that capital markets have been opened up is the fact that technology has been changing in a very important way. And those changes in technology are eroding the basis of the nation state. The ability, for example, to tax various kinds of commerce that's now moving to the internet. And to the extent, I think, that the extent that we manage to increase democracy within institutions like the IMF, which I think is a wonderful goal, it's going to be because of that erosion of national sovereignty that's coming from other forces. And your own organization, I think, is a part of that process.
And would you like to comment, or are you happy with that support?
Well, is this...
No, it's not your...
It's not our final...
It's not your wind-up, no. You can make a comment on that.
Well, that means I get two bites at the cherry.
Absolutely.
That's wonderful. I think this is a fundamentally flawed reasoning to assert that it's technology that's opening up capital markets. This is to assume that governments have not deliberately, from 1979 onwards, lifted exchange controls. This is to assume that central bankers have not deliberately allowed unlicensed lending. This is to assume that the bond markets have not exploded and that people can just simply go into the market and ask for credit and return a piece of paper, a bond, for that credit. And that the explosion in this kind of borrowing and lending is something that's happened because we've got computers or because we've got the internet. I'm sorry, that is not true. I understand, of course, that there's a great deal of commerce on the internet. And as somebody who struggles to buy and sell on the internet, indeed, who struggles to get onto the internet when I travel, I'm perfectly well aware of the role that technology plays. But I think what we've got here is a very blind spot to the role that central bankers have played and that governments have played. Because without that, we would not have had, you know, the capacity to use credit cards across the international financial system. Well, you see that I'm going to stick with my definition.
Okay.
And
right. Now I want to wind up this discussion by giving all the panel members the opportunity to speak for 1 minute to sum up their thoughts after this evening's discussion. And I'm going to take it in reverse order from which they spoke at the beginning. And so Anne gets, as she intimated in the beginning of her reply, to go first. Anne.
Thank you very much, John. I want to come back to this issue of human rights because I think it's fundamental and it's clear the audience has thought it important as well because it's come up several times. And I want to challenge Stefan because I thought what he said about poor countries neglecting human rights was close to being racist, frankly. And I think it comes about because of the way in which we define human rights. We define human rights in terms of whether or not poor countries incarcerate individuals in jails and do it in an unpleasant way and for the wrong reasons. Whereas I think we ought to be thinking about human rights in terms of what, for example, creditor nations do to debtor nations, to whole collective communities, when they impose the conditionalities that they impose on because that country is, for reasons which have both to do with the creditor and the debtor, become highly indebted. When whole nations can be stripped of rights and autonomy and sovereignty, whole nations. And that can be done by enlightened Western European nations who think that they are the upholders of human rights. I think we have to be extremely careful. I've just been in meetings with Bangladeshis who are struggling to retain their own cultural and human rights which are suffering from the impact of globalization. And who those people are clear that international financial institutions and Western institutions just do not know what those cultural and human rights are that are under such assault. I think these are really important issues, and I am worried that we don't have a full understanding of them and that we have a very patronizing and indeed almost racist attitude towards poor countries and the issue of human. We do not look at what rich countries have done to poor countries in the name of capital liberalization, in the name of lending, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, thank you very much. Karen.
It's 2 points. First, to quote Secretary Summers, the rising divergence in national incomes that we see today is not because more countries are integrating themselves with the global economy. It is because so many countries are not. But having said that, which is a statement of confidence that globalization can serve the greater global good and not just for the countries that are currently successfully operating in the globalized economy, but for the poorest developing countries as well. I'm not a market utopianist. I don't think that markets by themselves work everything out with the best result and the least damage and are self-equilibrating. I think it's very clear that if successful markets only operate within an effective legal framework, and the governance of that global economy is really what I think we have been grappling with. I thought you were quite correct to put the word governance in the title of this conference, because that is the challenge for policymakers, which is to formulate a governance framework that is seen as legitimate and as serving people around the globe, and that is both effective but also allows the markets to operate to their maximum efficiency in terms of improving the standards of living for everyone.
Right. Karen, thank you very much. Stefan.
Well, Anne, I must say it hurts. And maybe I should establish my credentials. Being German, Auschwitz is something I will never really get around. I have worked in Tanzania as a volunteer, and I have paid my dues to Ujamaa. So I have also always lived the questioning of a very poor country of why they have not become richer. I am president of the France-Burma Association, which is supporting refugees in France and fighting for democracy in Burma. I give that as a background just to explain that I've come to the end of my wits with a certain nature of militantism, which doesn't really seem to improve the world. So that I have tried to really go into the depth of the issue. Maybe I have failed, but I have really tried to look at what it is that both contributes to the creation of wealth and prosperity for people, and what it is that allows them to protect their human dignity. And I've come up with this model that, and a few sketches I presented at the beginning. Maybe I'm wrong, maybe it doesn't lead to anything, but I certainly wouldn't like it to be understood as being racist.
What's your webpage?
StefanColignon.de.
Right. Thank you. And finally, Michel.
StefanColignon.de.
See this program so you can get the spelling of Stefan's name from your program. Right. Michel.
There is a dangerous ideology that spread with the development of the free market in the 80s, that economics could take care of everything and that politics would certainly decline, the importance of politics would decline with the development of and the deepening of markets. What we are now, and what the crisis has shown, and I think what is going to be very apparent in the beginning of the century that is coming, is a return, the coming back of politics. Politics will come back because with the development of markets, the need for public goods, for collective goods, come at the same extent and intensity. And the markets and the organization of private people undersupply collective goods. So we'll see that, of course, in systemic risk, in financial credit. We'll see that in environmental problems. We see that about the unequal distribution of wealth in the world and so on. So the question is about the norm, not to be governed by automatic norms, by norms that we are not able to master. And the organizing a process of inventing and developing norms that we could master, and this process needs certainly cooperation between institutions that had just a national scope before, and more importance for organizations that are already truly international in character. But this process needs really a consciousness of externalities and the consciousness of the fact that we need really common goods at the world level, and this consciousness is very difficult to arise.
Thank you. Well, this evening has been quite extraordinary for me in the sense that when we started out in this discussion, I didn't expect that the discussion would be predominantly political, as it has been this evening. But I was clearly quite wrong, and Michel has illustrated why I was wrong, in the sense that there is the greatest vacuum in the sense of the learning how to manage the politics of the international economy is something which we are struggling with in the beginning of the 21st century. I would, however, say as a caveat that I don't think we should be too confident that we've got the economics right. I mean, I think there is a lot of problems in developing economic analysis of the international economy, particularly the relationship between, as Michel was describing it, individual actions and systemic actions, or problems of externalities and public goods. Those are issues which, on an international level, I don't think we understand terribly well. And so we might have wonderful political institutions, but if they were doing the wrong things, we would have still have significant international problems. By the way, on the issue of the role of politics and the relationship to the market, I do think that the two sides have to face up to significant problems. On the one hand, those who feel the market is not a satisfactory way of organizing things, have to face up to the fact that the last 200 years of modern capitalism have seen a greater alleviation of human misery than there ever before in human history. Capitalism has been very successful at reducing human misery. It may create human misery in parts, but it's been the most powerful organization for reducing human misery. But on the other hand, those who are in favor of markets have to face up to the fact that markets screw up desperately badly and screw up people's lives and create very severe crises within market systems. Markets, we've learned over those 200 years, need to be managed. There needs to be a political process of market management. That was the message of the Bretton Woods Conference, after all. That's what Keynes was trying to persuade everybody of in 1944. And it's an issue which is still with us today, as with the globalization of the economy, either financial or technological or whatever it might be, we're trying to grapple with managing this structure of markets. So those who want to manage have to face up to the fact that markets are successful creators of wealth. Those who are in favor of markets have to face up to the fact that markets have to be managed.
But what I want to really conclude by saying is to thank our panel very much indeed. We've had a wonderfully stimulating discussion this evening. Thank you very much, everybody, for participating. Okay, folks, you can go home now.